This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Stephen Carper, Mr. Roman Martinez, and Mr. Quentin Johnson. We're in Las Vegas, Nevada on the 1st of October, 1999. Time is approximately 4:30. Gentlemen, what I'd like you to do is go ahead and start on this side. Mr. Martinez, if you would, just give a quick biographical description of yourself, your name, where you're from, where you grew up, that kind of stuff.
Okay, I'm Roman Alexander Martinez, born in Richmond, California. Joined the Army right out of high school. Joined to be a chaplain's assistant.
Okay. Mr. Carper?
I'm Leslie Stephen Carper. Everybody knows me as Steve. And I was born in Miami, Florida. Lived southwest of Miami. As a teenager, moved to Louisiana, then California in 63. Went to South Pasadena Junior High and High School. Pasadena City College for one semester. Didn't like all the demonstrators. In March 1 of 1968, I enlisted in the Army, guaranteed aviation. Okay. And I was a helicopter, door gunner, and crew chief.
My name is Quentin Johnson. I was born, born and raised up in North Carolina, Yanceyville, North Carolina. In 69, I was inducted into the armed service, August of that year. January of that year, I was in Vietnam. I served with these two gentlemen, that two over there, as an infantry soldier. After that, I kind of got back home.
Okay. So, the training that you all received, once you, again, to go around real quickly, tell me where you were, where your first training occurred, basic training, and what that training was like in terms of, was it effective, was it good, was it bad?
Okay, I was trained at Fort Lewis, Washington. Like I said, I joined to be a chaplain's assistant. After basic training, I was sent to advanced infantry training, and I figured that something had gone awry because they didn't send me off to chaplain's assistant school. I was kind of confused. I had caught the measles in basic training, so my 8 weeks of basic training was only 7 weeks long because I had the measles. And then I went into advanced infantry training, and during that training period, I got a different kind of measles, so I was only spent 7 weeks in advanced infantry training. So my training had two blocks of information gone, and they told me I would get that information on the job.
What about the climate? Wasn't there something peculiar about the climate?
Fort Lewis, Washington, for preparation for Vietnam, training in the snow.
So this was after your advanced infantry training? Or?
Advanced infantry training was the day, the weekend. I mean, I had a weekend off and then redeployed to across the parade field to advanced infantry training in Fort Lewis.
Okay.
I joined in January, and so I had my training in the snow in Fort Lewis.
And where did you go after Fort Lewis?
Straight to Vietnam.
Okay.
2 weeks of R&R to kiss everybody goodbye, and then off to Vietnam. I was deployed to Vietnam on June 23rd, 1969.
Okay.
With holes in my training, and not a chaplain's assistant.
So you didn't feel very prepared for Vietnam, though?
No, I figured I was going to be cannon fodder, soon to die. But I was an altar boy and a choir boy prior to Vietnam, so I figured, like, I was in touch with God and ready to go to whatever adventures were ahead of me.
Given your faith, did you ever consider conscientious objection? Or?
I told them that I was a conscientious objector. They put me in recon.
you didn't, there was no recourse for that?
It was, yeah, LBJ, long been jail, or recon. So I gave up my Catholic background. I buried myself and the altar boy and my God, and participated in chili corn carnage with the 1st Infantry Division.
Was that an expression that they used there?
No, it was something that I made that I used to try to lessen the brutality of it all. You know, if it was, if the people you were killing had souls, it would hurt you too bad. So they had to be subhuman. And it didn't hurt so bad.
Okay, Mr. Carper, would you provide us with that information as far as where you went, when you went into basic?
I went to Fort Ord, California for basic training. I enjoyed it. I had no idea when they would make us jog with full gear and we'd sing, "I want to be an airborne ranger." I was never airborne, but I got stuck in the 101st Airborne. But anyway, the military is a, ever since the Civil War, we've had relatives in every war except for the Korean War. And my brother, in 66, he volunteered for 4 years in the infantry as 11 Bravo, and he told me find another job besides being in the infantry. So I figured aviation was the better way out. And fortunately enough, I was able to go to Fort Eustis, Virginia to train in helicopter mechanics and crew chief school. And then that was 12 weeks, and then 2 weeks in 67A1F, which was a door gunner training school, where you just fire blanks at targets. And it prepared me. I wanted to go to Vietnam and did, and served 12 months in the 1st Air Cav, and then came home, not expecting to ever go back to Vietnam. Spent 4 months in Fort Stewart, Georgia, and then a buddy of mine that had been with me since Fort Eustis, we both volunteered to go back. He ended up in the 1st Aviation Brigade, and I ended up with my two partners here, Roman, and I wanted to say Johnson or Quinn would be better.
Yeah.
Quinn. Mm-hmm. He thinks he's Quinn Eastwood. But anyway.
Couple of machine gunners.
You can delete that out of there if you want.
Do you think that the training you received at those various locations before you went to Vietnam the first time, that they were adequate, that they did prepare you for what you had to do?
Really in detail.
Mm-hmm. What about the blank training, as you put it?
I'm sorry?
The blank training, as you put it?
Oh, it was the blank training in door gunner school. If you fired your machine gun at a target that wasn't an enemy target, let's say they had to have a weapon aimed at you to be an enemy target. Don't be trigger happy and just fire at every pop-up target that they would have as you're flying along in the helicopter. See, they wanted to see if you had good judgment and that you could remain calm. Because at first when you're flying, you think you're just going to fall out. And you don't know really, but you learned in class that centrifugal force will
hold you in there.
And so you can lean as far as you want, really, without even wearing a seatbelt. We never wore seatbelts. The pilots did, but we never did. You wanted to be able to maneuver around. If the pilot got shot, you wanted to try to help him. If you had to give a lift to these guys, reach out. Let them grab your wrist or your hand. Pull them in if they need it. Because they're packing a lot of weight. And I totally respect those guys. I'd have to drop them off, and then I could go home and take warm showers and eat warm food while they were out there protecting us. So I have a lot of appreciation for my partners. Okay. And I'd do anything for them. No matter what situation they were in, if they needed us to come and help them, we'd be there.
All right. Mr. Johnson, would you do the same, please? Provide the basic information as far as your training and stuff.
Well, I went to in service in August of 69, went through basic training at Fort Bragg, and 8 weeks there. Well, really, it was 10 weeks, right? 2 0 weeks. And from there, I went to Fort McCullen, Alabama. That's where I took my infantry AIT training at. And from there, I had probably 15 days leave time from there to Vietnam. I got out there, I think somewhere around the 4th of January. And like I say, I wasn't with an airborne unit. I hadn't done any paratrooper jumping. So, but by being in the 101st, so they have to train you, you know, get you equipped for whatever you got to be in. So I had to go 2 weeks to a, what they call a P-training, learn rappel, jump from choppers. And from that, what, about the 15th or 16th of, or 17th of January, I joined 2nd 17th Cavalry B Troop. And, you know, you play war games back here in the real world, which is the United States. You get over there, you know, all this stuff for real. My first operation, I ran into an ambush. And I think the training really done some good. I thought they was kind of mean and a little hard on you. Mm-hmm. You know, you were driven pretty hard. And I think that was a mind thing that you had to get a person equipped for, especially a young kid off the street that, you know, come off the farm. You're under strict rules on your parents anyway. So we really never did a whole lot, you know, to really learn what really was happening out here in the real world. And when you get over there, you have to grow up. And this first fly fighting, and I think it really probably helped me save my life and other people's lives too, because old man raised food, but he didn't raise them damn food. I know bullets when they come by. And that was the incident that happened. Probably a few more steps, it'd probably been me. But the lieutenant got shot in the leg that day. And that was good on the training. And really fearful too. You're really scared, but the scared don't ever overcome you. You know, you look upon yourself. You got to do what you got to do. And a scared person, you just can't go just lay down. Even though all this stuff's going on, you got to adjust for the situation. And that's what I done. And
from so that, your training helped you.
Yeah, the training really helped me.
Okay. Well, I want to say that, you know, I was shortchanged 2 weeks. The training was adequate, as you can see. I'm still here. I missed 2 weeks of something good, but since I was sick, they just said, you know, I didn't have to repeat. I was glad that I didn't have to go through it over again, so yeah. I just took that little bit of a holiday off, but it worked.
Well, Mr. Johnson's point about his first experience with contact, I think, is a good one to follow up on. So why don't you, Ms. Martinez, tell us about your first experience under fire and what it was like and what were your experiences and
okay,
how did it affect you?
I was in the 1st Infantry Division. I was with a leg company for, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks when I got the scratch on my neck that put me in a hospital. No contact. You know, when you're with a large unit, company-sized unit, the enemy can hear you coming, so we just never did have any, we never did find anybody to make contact with. This was down in the 3 Corps flat area, heavy jungle. A lot of it was chopped down by Rome plow. And I said, didn't see any contact. After I came out of the hospital, after 10 days, I came back and I was quite put off that I wasn't a chaplain's assistant, you know, helping ammo and there. And I complained about, I joined the service to be a chaplain's assistant and I was a conscientious objector. And I got volunteered into a recon platoon. So I was in country about a month and a half, had seen no contact. Only Vietnamese I'd seen was the Soto girls and stuff like that. So when I was in the recon unit on my first deployment, they sent me out with resupply to the unit in the field and a weapon that was unknown to me, and sent me out to the field with another cherry guy that was sent in, and everybody else is wearing boonie caps. And I went out to the field with a baseball cap, and these guys about to laugh us out the field, you know. What the heck are you doing out here with this? And so they threw away my baseball cap and gave me a boonie cap. And before we, you know, got our supplies, our food, and got ready to set off, we made contact. And one of the things during that period, they were into the old Vietnamization stuff. We'd holler out, Chu Hoi means open arms. And if the enemy wanted to surrender, they would stand up and put their hands up in the air. And so we'd holler out, Chu Hoi, And if the person wanted to surrender, they'd stick their hands up in the air and we'd kill them. So that was my experience at first contact. The guys I was with in the recon unit had been blown up severely, and the guy that took me under his wing when he was a point man had 25 men behind him wiped out in ambush, and he lived through it. So he had this great vendetta to live through. And he trained me in kill them all and let God sort it out.
What happened with your weapon that day?
Oh, yes. The first contact, first bullet jammed.
What kind of weapon was it?
M16. And I had a field strip, my weapon laying in the elephant grass. And when I got up, all these guys are throwing hand grenades and blowing up guys. They were hollering, "Joy, joy!" And it took me quite a while for me to comprehend what we had just did. You know?
Was this a policy of just your particular recon platoon, or was this
yes.
a recon policy?
Well, no, it was no, it was not policy. The policy was you take prisoners.
Right.
But you get engaged into a the Vietnamese has become so treacherous, you couldn't trust them.
No.
You know, he could say too hard and walk up to you and have a bomb on him and blow all of you up.
Yeah.
So you have to understand why.
Oh, yeah.
This was
oh, yeah.
murderers, you know. You hit your own life at stake. They had got so treacherous, they sent a little kid in there upon you. Mm-hmm. And we had always showed mercy for
children
and women. They were sending a little 5-6-year-old kid in there with a bomb on it just to kill 10, 12, 16, 20 GI. They really get to 20.
Mm-hmm. Well, they wanted
sacrifice that kid.
Yep.
And you know, it's really, really sad, you know, that we had to shoot them guys because they said it's too hard, but they fired upon us first. You probably remember Lieutenant Kelly. He was over there at the same time we was over there. Mm-hmm. He was court-martialed Fort Meade, Maryland. Yeah, they brought him back there. I was there. Just coincidentally, I winds up at this base, and he were court-martialed for that. But they had his company, I mean, his platoon pinned down. And these are supposed to be civilian, supposed to be friendly. But why are they shooting at them? He called back to ask for permission to fire upon a friendly village. They denied him. And bullets popping all around you. He's got probably 30 or 40 men out there.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do? He going to just let these people sit down and murder his platoon?
No.
So he took it upon himself. He left that village. Put a VC in it. That's all it were. Mm-hmm.
But, Mr. Carper, what about your first contact?
It was after I first had gotten over there, I was a mechanic, very disappointed mechanic, because I wanted to fly. I kept volunteering to fly or get into a unit to fly. And then they would use me on what they call details, and I would go off in another unit and fill in as a door gunner to get experience. And then after 6 months of being in Vietnam, I was fortunate enough to go to B Company 227th Aviation, and we were starting to take troops into Cambodia. This was in May of 69 and June of 69. And I'm fortunate enough to have a first cab photographer that took a picture of our helicopter in Cambodia at home. And it has a Cupid on the front, and it says Lovebird, but we had painted on there. And that's how I asked the photographer when I was going home after being in the cab for a year, "Do you have any pictures of it?" He told me he had pictures of helicopters in Cambodia, and I said, "Do you have one with the Lovebird on the front?" He goes, "Yeah, it has Cupid." He got in his briefcase, he pulled it out, and he let me have it. It's an 8x10 black and white. And on the back it says U.S. Cavalry photographer and his name.
Were you on that pitch?
Ronnie was. It was on Ronnie's side. I was the door gunner on the other side. Ronnie was on the Oliver. He's from Arkansas. He was the crew chief, so he was on the left side. So I'm not in the picture. I'm on the other side of the transmission. But still, that was our ship. But that was my first experience going into Cambodia. And we take fire, and naturally, you just want happiness as a warm gun. You know, you just make that 60 sing, and that would make the pilots happy, as well as the infantry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have
that prep fire can make them put their heads down, and then you keep their heads down after you get your infantry on the ground. You're like their backup until you get out of there. And then I don't want to say they're on their own because the gunships keep making runs and passing over to protect your infantry.
It was nice there.
You could have branches falling off the trees right next to your chopper, and that's how good the pilots were. Because in the first air cab, they were called Blue Max. They had the blue swastika on their cowling. Mm-hmm. And the Cobra pilots in the 2nd 17th, 101st were just as good as the Blue Max pilots. Mr. Aiken, he was one of, not Mr. Captain then, that just passed away last Christmas Eve of 98.
Pardon? Bob Aiken.
Aiken, he lived in Texas.
He flew the gunship.
Yeah, he would always fly at my 7. There was one mm-hmm. gunship at the 5 mm-hmm. and one at the 7, both Cobras. They would fly a little higher and behind you, and they were, all you had to say was taking fire at 10 o'clock.
Hey, man,
and they were firing 2.75 rockets, shooting a minigun with a grenade launcher.
Yeah, I seen them.
And 20 Mike.
They just cut out trees.
There were occasions when they would fire their 20 Mike, and the flashes when they would hit, I would think we were taking fire when actually we weren't taking fire. It was just the 20 Mike going
on next to us. They just want to go ahead and unload.
Happiness is a warm gun. Yeah. And what can I say?
Yeah. They looked out for us. I mean, we had a heck of a game on the ground, but they got it in there.
But you had the feeling of invincibility when you had two Cobras in your pocket. Mm-hmm. It was like you're the baddest. Your balls are dragging on the ground. You got cannons, and these guys will sick them, and the bad guys go away.
And they had the teeth on the front, like in World War II, and the Asian or Oriental people are afraid of the sharks.
They had a shark teeth.
The sharks are coming in.
That way come in. This thing was bad. That thing had a cylinder, like this big round, and it had rockets. I forget, I used to load that thing.
2.75.
How many rockets would in one side, one chamber?
I want to say 25. I'm guessing right now, so I won't say.
He's packing two on each side.
I won't say, yeah.
He's packing two of these canisters on each side, mm-hmm. and they load it like little round cylinders. Uh-huh. And he can shoot each one of them.
With fins on them.
Shoot them at you. Them rocks are bad. Cut the top of our trees now.
Yeah.
Make a big boom.
So those were your favorite weapons then?
That was our toy. I mean, that was our
backup. Guys worked out.
We were on the ground, but they
had ground support.
It was like having instant artillery, you know. And
they always there when you were on the ground?
Well, in B Troop, we had them pretty much.
They were with us.
Just going in and coming out. Mm-hmm. Pretty much, like when we was out there reconnaissance or, most of it reconnaissance.
Uh-huh.
All the time, in the down aircraft, we had to secure.
Right. That was one of our jobs.
Yeah, and we had to jump and do that.
And
back up for the Rangers, most of the time, it was pickup time, they were supposed to not make enemy contact no way.
Right, they were out there to observe.
Stupid around to observe. Mm-hmm. But they would sneak in on them. They would be a calm. They were real smart. They would sneak in on them a lot, man. They would slip in on the dark and kill them in the sleep and stuff. And we were reactionary for them. We had to pick them up. Well, we had to find them. They lose contact, radio contact. You assume something has happened. Mm-hmm. And 9 times out of 10, you had. One time we went out there, all we would have been allowed. This one kid, I think this was about his fourth or fifth time out there, four or fifth days out there. He hadn't been out there long. He was a new Ranger. Everyone got killed, this one kid. But he was shot mm-hmm. twice in the small of the back. Mm. He was shot in both shoulders, he was shot in both legs. He was carrying the trick 25, and he was still running around out there.
There were times that the NDA...
He just didn't get hit at the right place, and they were shooting him with an AK-47, too.
They would keep the Rangers alive. They may kill two out of five.
Yeah.
But they would not kill the other three because they knew as long as they left them alive that the choppers would keep coming in to try to pick them up.
Yeah.
And so they, that was like a big brownie button if you shot down a chopper.
Yeah.
And especially if the chopper landed on the Rangers. And they killed the Rangers that were on the ground and the crew and if they had infantry on board to set up a perimeter of any kind, you get a big brownie button as an NVA if you shoot down a chopper full of infantry and they land on the Rangers and kill them too.
Well, you know, like killing 10 birds with one stone. Mm-hmm. That's what they were after.
Oh, yeah. They were smart.
So why don't you tell us about Operation Texas Star?
Operation Texas Star actually started in April. This is my recollection because I got there in May of 70. Was our main mission was aerial recon or to pick up any down air crews or Rangers that were just out there observing. They were, let's say they were found and needed to get out immediately. And when all attempts were made to get them out and no one else could do it, they would send in the 2nd 17th B Troop. We covered the Oshawa Valley right out of Way. Any Marine, I don't know why they call H-U-E, U. It's Way. And it goes through the Oshawa over to the Laotian border and up to the DMZ. And did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. Okay. So what were some of the operations that you conducted as part of Operation Texas Star? Some of the specific actions?
I'd like to share one that has done more to my psyche than any of them. I joined the unit in first part of April 1970, and this was maybe a couple of weeks later. We were sent out to pick up one of our own downed loaches, three crewmen. And we went out first light. You know, they went down, and I thought we were picking up live crew. The ship went down, and we're going to pick them up. So we get out before breakfast, and we're humping. They put us down at the bottom of this hill, and they told us it was near the crest. So we're breaking brush, and I'm walking point through up the hill. And several hours have passed on the way up the hill, and I start smelling these interesting smells, like McDonald's, you know. It's like somebody's cooking something, you know. And it was, didn't dawn on me, because we're going to pick up live guys. I was figuring, oh, maybe there's a vill around here where somebody's cooking meals, you know. And I'm salivating like crazy. And we break the brush and get into a clearing. And we notice that the clearing is not natural. And in the middle of the clearing is a pile of ashes with three bumps in it. And then I found out what them interesting smells were. It was magnesium cooked GIs. And we set up a perimeter around the site. Most of the guys started barfing their socks out. And me and this black Ford Observer. Can you remember his name?
Was it Super?
No.
Was it Super?
It was. Was he was a attached store?
With Sergeant Hollum.
Hollum. Yes. We bagged the three guys, and it kind of pissed me off that the other guys were either crying or puking and wouldn't do it. So it's me and Sergeant Holland was the one that actually bagged the guys. And I did it with tears in my eyes and the flesh coming off of my hands when we were putting them in the bags. And it was just grossing me out to think that I was salivating a little bit before over these good smells of my brothers.
You forgot the part where you were close with David and Robert.
Well, I had met them the night before. Mm-hmm. I did have pictures of us attaining euphoria in the bleachers in the in the base area.
They give us movies. Remember they used to show movies up there. They had, we had a little small theater. We was outside, little bleachers. You sit on.
Right. So that we were out there, and I had just met guys the night before, and these were the guys that we picked up in the morning, and it was just a real, experience to find out that, here, this is our brothers that we had to go pick up and then take them back.
It has ruined our family's barbecues ever since. We barbecue fish. I'm not kidding. We barbecue fish now.
Well, I used to have a real bad time at barbecues.
Bad time.
And didn't have any idea what it was, but until I was in therapy, I found out.
You would turn into a monster, and the girls would have to go hide in their bedroom, and I'd lock their door and make sure that they had an escape route and where to go, and Daddy would go nuts.
I'm much better now.
He's much better.
Much better now.
Well, you got to live through it. It ties you inside up. You get something within you. You got to live it out. It just don't go away. A lot of people say, "Well, we're just gonna forget about it." just don't.
They
forget
haven't
about
been
it.
There.
Just like your childhood, you just can't forget about it. So there's a experience there. I imagine all of us are sick to a certain extent. Nowhere around it. I mean, the main thing is you come to terms to yourself with yourself and try to help yourself.
Mm-hmm. And help each other. That's why I try to share this with guys, because there's a lot of us who are not here, that have died because we couldn't deal with it. 58,000 vets died in Nam, and over 300,000 have killed themselves. And I'm sporting other kind of scars, physically and mental. And by the grace of God, I'm still here.
Same thing here.
Oh,
grace of God.
Did you conduct a lot of
Guardian
aircraft recoveries like that, or was that one of the most extreme?
Well, that was my first and most extreme one. I have a feeling that I was on some of these other operations that the guys were talking about.
But you learn to adapt to it. That first experience, I think it's the most devastating one. You don't forget it. And I think after that one, you kind of come to terms with it, and you more like accept it to yourself. And the next time something happens, it's not as bad looking as that first one. Like that firefighter first one I went through now, I wasn't expecting that, and my mind was nowhere near that, and that happened, but it woke me up. And like when we picked those Rangers up that time, they got missing one night, and it was going all day, all that next night, and they put us out there the next morning. We found them, and they was smelling so bad we had to put on gas masks. So it's probably the ones that y'all had to carry in.
Yeah.
What happened to these Rangers?
They got stolen in the middle of the night. The way I looked at it, position of them. You got five or six men with the operating Rangers team anyway, so. Yeah, come time of night, you gotta sleep. So, four sleep, if it's five of them, four sleep, one guard for 2 hours. Wake one up, the next one is on guard, and then he'll take over. He'll stay work for 2 hours, and then the other four is still sleeping. Well, you'll get 8 hours sleep, or as much as 6 hours sleep in rotation like that. But one that's wake up, from asleep, they ain't been slept for 2 hours or maybe 4 hours. He's subject to go back to sleep. And then that's where I played my mind. And I look at where these guys were positioned at. He won't be sitting upside a tree. I imagine he the one supposed to be guarding. He falls back to sleep. And I don't know. You don't know what you do in your sleep. You don't know what you snore. If nobody else don't tell you snore, you never know you snore. And these Vivicons, they were professionals. Just like ourselves. They crawl in and they kill them in the sleep. They surround them. I imagine Because I saw how they were shot up, you know, bullets shot all up in the head and mouth shot off and flopping around and, you know, brain shot out the back of the head. And then you see these guys laying there, laying on his back, you know, and blood just run down and meat. And, you know, all this stuff is just playing for you. You know, you never forget it. You never forget that look, like you never forget that smell of human body, human flesh. And, you know, in your mind, I said, now, I'm picking this guy up. I wonder who's going to pick me up. You know, just the way my mind played to me. I guess that was kind of like a defense that I was really playing to myself. But it got so rough. You know, I wrote my mom a letter. I told her things real bad. And if anything happened, don't be surprised. You know, tell me, because, you know, right before Sergeant Wall got killed. And we really ran into a lot of contact, enemy contact with it. It's a lot of bullets shot at us.
And that contact would occur when you'd go in to either rescue a downed unit or a downed aircraft?
For reconnaissance, too.
Yes, most of the time we run into was reconnaissance. They hardly ever, now, most of the time, they fear those helicopters, those five helicopters, those white rings around those tailbones, because those were the blue. They feared them. They feared that helicopter because they knew what those people was all about. And they knew if they killed them, they knew what was coming in behind them. We just didn't have those gunship, those helicopters flying down. We had phantoms, too. We were
past moon.
Yeah, now we had some phantoms come in with back for us a couple times. I think you was already gone. You had got wounded or gone then. This was somewhere around in this is Quantry. Well, yeah, we was up in Quantry when this happened. Somewhere around August or September of that year. And this phantom worked out, man. This thing is showing up, man. Man, he comes in, man.
August.
And he dropped them two rockets, you know, big rockets. Them thing rock like that, man, when they go to the ground.
Napalm.
This food is up here.
Yeah.
And he works out, man. He come back around. I mean, you can see a mountainside that's green. When this man get through working out, about 8 or 12 rockets. I mean, I don't know how big that. He probably been in this table around. And when he get through working out, when his clearance go away, you don't see them naked ground. So we had power. We had tremendous power. Then we had the mortars. The mortars, you know, a couple times we call them mortars attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, more than a couple of times. Right, one time you call. First time you got to set a mark around, and it explode on top of your head, then you adjust from there. You want it to explode over your head so they'll know exactly where you're at. Because mortars don't play wherever you drop it. If it's on you, you know, you're shit quick.
And most of these operations were during the day, correct?
Did you do operations much? Oh, yes.
Yeah. We did layovers, but it wasn't actually an operation that we deployed to. You know, we were there.
You more like, well, Westmoreland, he flew out, he snooped around, you know, he was nosy. He found something he didn't like or didn't see, or somebody shot at him, then called the blues. We was his boy.
Mm-hmm.
They shot at him, we jumped in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just where it was. And he was a little snooper now. He had a little loop, you know, like they put on Magnum PI, the little bubble. And that's what he wrote. And that thing was fast. It was only a helicopter to fly upside down, right? It can turn all the way over and come back and keep going. I don't know what
it's like a bumblebee.
I don't know what the slicks to do that or not.
No, I wouldn't want my, it would be too much torque.
Might break something.
Yeah.
But it was the only helicopter I know of, you know, back then that could really maneuver around fast and shoot down. And it was pretty quick helicopter. It was small. Would it hold two people?
Two to three. You could have a pilot, co-pilot, and a gunner in the back.
In the back of
it. Yeah. It would balance things off with the minigun on the other side.
Okay. But that's most of what was going on. And I was mostly contact was when we were just reconnaissance.
What would be the purpose of those operations usually when you go out on a recon?
Westmoreland probably seen something.
Yeah.
He saw something that he wanted to check out. He gave me, it could be anything.
Hospital complex.
Search for the enemy.
Yeah.
It was amazing. That's why you were there. Yeah.
You hunted him. That's what we done. We hunted him.
So what size was your team on the recon?
30 men in this troop, B troop. It was four troops, A, B, C, and D. And it was 30 men.
We didn't go out 30 men at a time, though.
Yeah. Yes, it were. It was 30 of us. Think about it. There were five and six of those helicopters that was carrying us out. It was 30 of us. It was a bunch of us, man.
Mm-hmm.
it didn't really seem like 30 million. You know, we probably went small because, you know, we had 100, like a line unit was about 150, mm-hmm. 150 million.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you were always in the lead ship, bro, because you were doing points, yeah, so you didn't see what was behind you.
Well, you never thought about that.
You don't think about the guys behind you.
You never thought about it. I think what got me into counting them, I never thought about it after I got walking point. Just after you got wounded, I started walking point. And you got to give me counters. Say, I always flew the first chopper in and come out on the last chopper. I had to make sure all the men's mm-hmm. on the chopper. Mm-hmm. And like when they dropped that arc light on us, they had mm-hmm. 20 minutes. And these guys, they were saying it was impossible for them to get back to us. But they got back to us. And we were in the air I wrote that last chopper out. And we were in the air. The Vargas, Puerto Rican, that got that strap metal on that firefight we jumped in, he slipped. And when I jumped on the skid, I hooked the little bar, you know what the little bar is at? Mm-hmm. And I grabbed him I grabbed it in his back, and that way we left off the ground. Because mm-hmm. we didn't have no time to get out of Orc Light, it's 3 10,000-pound bomb. Mm-hmm. And you drop it on Las Vegas, you probably won't have nothing here left. You know?
Make a mess.
And we wasn't going to really drop directly on it, but we were so close to it, the sound wave would have killed us. Just like you take a tuning fork and stick a side of glass and shatter it. Where your body can't take it. Mm-hmm. But these guys got us out of there.
I asked Captain Yearwood, did anybody have a briefing prior to this mission? Because we were in the middle of, they were dropping bombs.
they had dropped us off on a helicopter. What we have to do is secure this helicopter to a Chinook, come in and chain lift this thing up and fly back. Because we didn't want the enemy to get over to this driving equipment, like the gauge, instrumentation, the gauge and stuff. This stuff will. When helicopters over $1 million, so they didn't want the enemy to get into this part of this helicopter to know what we were really using. So they would go to the stream side of helicopter, and they had all the way back to camp. And when they got the word that the Hawk like would be dropped,
we were something
like what, about 50 miles out there or more. We was a long ways out there.
We were topping off with fuel, and I could hear it on the radio, and they asked Yearwood, since we had just been there, if he would go back. And so he just gave it in the affirmative. He was going for the mission, and he never turned down a mission. And so we were on our way back to pick you guys up.
I mean, they come back.
This is your pilot that never turned down a mission?
Right, he was our platoon leader, he was a platoon leader of the lift section, and also being that he was an Army infantry ranger, he would go out in the field with the Blues, too. In fact, that's what he did mm-hmm. After the second time I was shot.
Yeah.
His other 6 months of his tour, he spent in the infantry.
And what was his name again?
Captain John Yearwood. In your roster, it says he was a Cobra pilot. Mm-hmm. And if he flew Cobras, it was after I was with him.
He flew Hueys when he was with
you. Right. Uh-huh. And he was he really thought a lot of his men. We do, like I say, anything at all to protect them, to pick them up, to get them out of a bad situation. Captain Yearwood, if he had to save intimidating two other air crews, he would rather make 3 runs to pick them up than to have to endanger the lives of 8 other crewmen and 2 other helicopters.
Mm-hmm, he would. Mm-hmm. That spoke great because we knew this man would die trying to save us. See what I'm saying? And so we give it the utmost. When they come in, we all them on fire. Mm-hmm. They come in shooting, we all ready to shoot.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like your unit had good morale.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they kept
it
that up.
It
they kept us in getting good morale.
I felt like you were a bunch of cowboys.
Yeah. But with cobras in our pocket.
And yeah, cobras. Juan Wayne over here and J.J.
And they had showers. We had showers. Mm-hmm. And they give you things of what we were accustomed to uh-huh. of living in the United States. And that right there was for one reason, to keep our morale up. Mm-hmm. Because you take the morale away from the man, you ain't got no man.
Important factor that we didn't do in the 1st Air Cavalry, it was we didn't, okay, the infantry, when we'd pick them up and drop them off, I never really got to know them like I knew these guys, because back at Camp Eagle, they had a hooch or a little house,
we all field day together.
And so we were more together as a family. First cab, I could have gone in and out, picking troops up and dropping them off. I would recognize them, and they always knew me for having an ice chest with cold sodas. And I would offer them cold sodas, and just give me the can, because I don't want it flying up in my rotor blades when you get out and throw it on the ground.
More for you.
Anyway, I admit I spent a lot of time on standby, which I had a hammock I would set up. And have a radio going and cold sodas, and I had it made compared to these guys. I didn't have to burn leeches off of me with a cigarette.
Oh, man, when you miss them leeches.
You know, Roman always talks about the big difference of staying in the jungle wet for like 3 weeks at a time and having his own hooch. And that really was a big difference in his morale between the 1st Infantry and the 2nd and 17th.
So the physical comfortures in B Troop were much higher.
I went to heaven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was his just reward.
By being in hoochies, you got a chance to pull your socks and shoes off. And how you feel. Mosquito net. But you still got jungle rot, though. You know, you get the fungus.
Yeah, but if
no leeches.
If you don't sleep with wet clothes for three weeks.
We got a chance to get them off of us. Called you. When you got back off a wet operation, first thing you do, put your clothes on, you search for leeches. Because he owns you.
What was the longest trip that you took out into the field, the longest time you were away from your hooches?
I was out there when we went to Quan Tree that time. When do you leave? When do you leave? In 70. Did you leave?
November.
Near the end
of November.
You were probably flying with us when we went to Horn Tree, to that DMZ.
We sure got a lot of souvenirs.
Yeah.
I at home right now still have an NVA pack, pith helmet, and I did have his shirt and shorts and first aid kit.
We stripped them all. You know, we got all the dishes off when we could, and we turned all the clothes and stuff in. You guys were probably picking them up. And the longest time we stayed up there, I think we were really out there for 3.5 days. They were just dropping our food out.
The time I was there,
You could hear them moving at night. You could hear them moving. You be quiet, your ears go a long way. Mm-hmm. You go further than your eyes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, I'm scared of the dog. I'd rather be in the dog than be in the daylight. Mm-hmm. If you're in the dog, you ain't going to know I'm out there. But you might see me in the daylight. I might move, you know. But dog is your best friend.
That's interesting you say that, because, of course, part of the adage of, comments made about the Vietnam War is the night belonged to Charlie.
That's what they say.
The Viet Cong and the Vietnamese were the ones that took advantage of the night. Mm-hmm. The American soldiers tended to just operate during the day.
Mm-hmm. Tell them about your rest overnight.
This is with 1st Infantry Division, and we had night defensive positions where you set up ambush or to fight, or you had rest overnight where you're not going to set up an ambush, but you're just going to pull back and protect yourself. But our recon unit, we developed something even beyond that. We called it the hide overnight, where we'd go set up an ambush, and then we'd go a couple of clicks away and crawl into some thicket and hide. So, and then we just listened for the boom, because our claymores were self-actuating with white phosphorus in the trees and hand grenades and claymores. And so if anything fell into our trap, we had physical evidence. We'd go back in the morning and see how many bodies are still kicking, and then count, because usually they're pretty devastating. It's a big enough unit that they'd pick up the pieces before we got there, then we'd just get the hell out of Dodge, because but usually it would be just a small unit, maybe 3 or 4, and then you go out there and you have all your evidence right there.
But one time we went out, you probably remember this too. I'm trying to think that we were somewhere over next to Laos.
Mm-hmm. Or in Laos.
Mm-hmm. It might have been in Laos.
Yeah, I think it was wounded in Laos.
And,
wouldn't be surprising.
This helicopter, he got shot down. Mm-hmm. And it was late this afternoon. We jumped. We had spent the night. Okay?
A Loach?
No, it was a Huey. Okay. I don't think it was one. It wasn't 1 hour, but it went down.
It was
down.
In our AO.
Yeah, probably in our AO. We never found the pilot, the co-pilot, the gunner, or the crew chief. Yeah, I imagine, because it didn't crash and explode. It crashed.
Hit the trees?
More like just ground.
Fell apart?
Yeah, but it was still kind of together, but the prop stuff broke down.
Oh, okay, the rotor blades?
Yeah, it broke down off of it. But the instrument gauges and stuff, it wasn't destroyed. But you could tell it crashed. But not enough to explode or to kill those guys, because we never even find it. But we spent the night. And we could hear noises all around. We shot our own men this night.
Okay, now, everything was intact?
Now, we moved down from that chopper and formed the perimeter. It's kind of like on a little nose. We were in the mountain, kind of went back up. Trees kind of pretty tall. Trees are taller over there than it is over here anyway. But maybe about 200 or 300 meters from us was a land company. And we didn't know it was there, right? But through the night, not skip nothing. Got dusty dawn, we put out those claymores.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody moved out. And I can't think of this kid's name. He was slim and tall. He went out, nobody heard him. And you're powered off anyway. Mm-hmm. You're always two. Then you maybe go 25 feet, two more. Where you could be in visible sight of each other, but not too close. Just in case the mortar start coming in, maybe you got a better chance of surviving. He goes out, and we heard some noise. Sergeant Hart was with us.
Mm.
And I was an old timer then. I was in the perimeter with it inside. I was inside with the lieutenant and Patrick 25. Mm-hmm. They always set up in the center of the perimeter. And I was the point man, so I was in the center talking to Sergeant Hart. And we heard something. We really heard some noise where out. But then all of a sudden, we heard something right there.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, "Did you hear that?" I said, "Shh." And all of a sudden, you hear something. Now limb breaking.
Mm.
I said, "Now what is this?" By this time, you're trying to zero in where this noise coming from. But this guy, he was crawling over top of this stuff, and it was why he would step on something and break it. Why he went out there after got black dog? Don't ask me or because when we put the password out, put the claymores out, you're supposed to go and put the claymores out to come on in. Mm-hmm. That's at dusty dawn. Mm-hmm. It's hard to see at dusty dawn. And everybody does at the same time. And we opened up fire. I helped shoot the man too. But he was real fortunate. He was kind of tall and slim. And while we were shooting at, we were shooting down a bunch. One bullet hit him in the elbow.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard him when he went, "Ooh." And I said, "Damn." I said, "It's all our men accounted for." And then you start shooting up those starlight, your flares.
Yeah.
You shoot up your flare.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to ease it down and we got to call. And then all of a sudden we said, "We got one man missing."
Mm.
And I can't think of this guy's name for nothing, but I got his face. But the bullets were hitting in front of him and it ricocheted and it knocks rocks and stuff into his stomach.
Mm-hmm.
But he lived. He was real fortunate that a bullet didn't hit him in the head. One of them hit him in the elbow.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only, that disturbed me. Mm-hmm. I think it got to Sergeant Hart, too. Because me and him both, he was the first one to open up fire, and I opened up fire right behind him. Because we done what we supposed to have done, because we could have been surrounded. So we spend, gets him out. We're going to let him know where we was at, all this going on.
Mm-hmm.
That made me more worried. So, moving all around. See, then we found out it's the line company not far from us. They gets in contact. Dawn that morning, they gets in contact. Hey, come this helicopter. Must have been calling in support for them, not even knowing we over there. They boom, 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 boom. You know how they fly in and come back around. And this one chopper gunship come, and he was just firing up. Pop, 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 pop. And then he just made a half left turn. Banked in toward us and fired a rocket. Hey man, that thing hit the treetop.
No, thanks.
It hit the treetop right on top of it. It won't snake. This was a gunship.
Oh.
This was one of those Cobras, man. And then we got Lieutenant got on the Pleat 25 and was trying to give our position.
Mm-hmm.
And then they called back and said that nobody had engaged them I reported that we was out there. This man didn't even know we was out there. Mm-hmm.
Friendly fire.
He didn't know. He was just firing random. Because this line unit, they're like, you know, the jungle's thick. It's like from here, what, 1,000 meters? How long would it take you to travel 1,000 meters?
Depends on the jungle.
That's what I'm talking about. It's just so thick, man, it might take you all day. All day. But they really weren't that far from us. But this good ship didn't know we were out there. We out there because the damn helicopter went down late that evening. Mm-hmm. Before, that evening before. And that drawed us out there. Mm-hmm. And this line coming already. Exactly. 1,000 meters from us.
Mm-hmm. What did the chopper engage your unit?
Well, he didn't know we was out there. When he fired that round, he was just protecting himself, no doubt. He come in there and working out, and then he turned a half round, and he just shot that rocket. But we just shoot up the area, really, what we do.
But what was the provocation? You didn't fire on him, did
No, we didn't. He didn't see us. He didn't know we was out there.
Oh, okay.
He didn't know
we was
out there.
He was just firing because maybe there was something there.
Yeah.
That was to help the line element.
Well, see,
because the line element.
You got a line company out here, right here, and they on the fire. He come in, he gonna work this perimeter out. Here we said no here. It's easy for him coming there firing all through here, and then all of a sudden he fire over here too. You fire anywhere outside of where these people are.
You're trying to protect these people, inside.
And we said no here, not even knowing.
Were they getting hit? The line company, were they getting hit pretty hard or?
They said it was under pretty heavy fire.
You had to be hear it or. You weren't close enough to hear what was going on?
Well, I think a matter of fact did come in. Somebody got shot. Mm-hmm. I never know whether or not I got killed out of the operation, but I do know the first aid chopper come in, mm-hmm. I call it. Medevac chopper come in Hubbard. I don't know how many they took out of there. But when the helicopter come in, that was pretty good way. Wait, we could still see the helicopter. It's really dangerous on the helicopter. If you're flying along, it's dangerous. But when you hover, see, these machines here can stand still in the air and just stand there. Well, you're setting ducks.
You don't think of that part, though.
But you're setting ducks.
You think of getting the troops out. You don't think about how I'm worried because I'm going to get shot at. You just get them out.
But they're setting ducks.
And you can go home and count the holes later.
But you be counting. I know y'all find them when you get back. Yeah. I know they find them when they get back home.
And then they start peeing all over themselves.
No. One round can bring that chopper out of right by. We're all talking
if you hit
head.
The right line.
One
yes.
little spot. But it be.
Didn't you come home without any oil one time?
Oh, yeah. We made it back, and maintenance told Captain Yearwood, I don't know how this helicopter flew all the way to Fubai across the Oshawa Valley, because there's no transmission fluid in the transmission. And it should have frozen up, which means the rotor blade should have quit.
And
Captain Yearwood couldn't understand it. Not until 95 did I tell him, I was praying all the way, sir. I would pray for everybody on the ship, and I'd leave myself for last. And I'd say a prayer before we go in, and then I'd thank God after we got out of there.
I think so, like me now.
Did a hydraulic line get hit or something, or what happened? Why wasn't there transmission fluid in it?
It took at least 10 rounds in the transmission. I happened to make a lucky... it was very fortunate that I was hit at the very beginning of the trying to insert the blues on a hilltop, because it knocked me on the floor, and then in turn... they continued to fire, but I fell so fast to the floor because it came through the wall around a tumbler, armor-piercing tumbler, and it hit me in the upper thigh on the left and knocked me to the right. And lucky enough, the Blues, they were out on the skids ready to jump, and then they were smart enough, because we always had the smartest ones with us because they had the most experience. They stayed on board. And then Captain Yearwood just pulled pitch, and we got the heck out of there.
So we did.
But I can remember laying on the floor.
He's hit.
And Walt, he ruined a brand new pair of my Nomex. And I could, I would always be observing the gauges in case something would go wrong, or looking for a place to set down if we needed to in an emergency.
And this was the first time you were shot, or?
Yeah, it was the first time I was ever shot. I've been shot at a lot, but it was the very first time actually that I was hit.
What were you hit with?
It was an armor-piercing tumbler that made a big hole. And then I kept it in my thigh, in my right thigh. It stopped about an inch from the right side. I kept it in my thigh for a year and a half because in the hospital there were surgeries that needed to be done, and this is one of the surgeries that only hit flesh, so that I just wanted to go back to my unit. So I would go to therapy every morning. And the guy thought I was crazy because he says, you have clean sheets, nurses, movies, you're safe here. I don't understand why you want to go back to your unit. Because they need me. Captain Yearwood, I have to get back to helping, and that's what I'm trained to do. And I'm not doing any good sitting here in the hospital, so I want to go back to my unit. So actually they sent me back before I should go back, because I came back with a cane. And they would not, I would not pass the flight physical if they were to give me one, but I was a fast talker and was able to persuade Captain Yearwood that he needed me. And so he just said, well, if we get shot down, you're going to have a hard time running from the bad guys. And I just told him, well, I'll probably outrun you anyway. So he let me go with him.
Did Captain Rosenthal tell you that?
No, Yearwood.
Yearwood.
Uh-huh.
What about the...
Go ahead.
No.
Yearwood, he really... His men were before... let's say his men were being shot at. He would throw himself in front of the rounds if he could. That's how much it meant for him to get his men out. And I really respect him.
Were all the officers and NCOs in your units like him?
He was a West Pointer. He did not have to go in the military. He had an older brother, and his dad were both killed in the military. He was an only son now with his brother gone. He did not have to go in the military, but he volunteered, went through West Point, became an airborne infantry ranger, aviator. And then I would always add, at the end, Texan. Because he was a tall Texan, and he still, to this day, chews that chaw in his upper lip.
I like to see that, man.
Yeah, I would too.
But I don't think all of the officers were as...
No.
Especially the NCOs, huh?
What about the NCOs?
Well, they were...
There's
some
a couple
of them. Some of them deserved to die. I didn't frag any of them, but...
He used to follow Roman around with his pistol cock.
No, his
oh, it was his machine gun?
Car 15,
oh,
yeah.
Okay. Even was.
Yeah. So, sometimes the enemy wasn't little yellow... devils, you know.
Was
so big white devils. No, but I thought of it.
None in B troop while you were there? No one was fragged?
No.
No one
fantasized that maybe.
Nobody what now?
Fragged. No one was fragged.
No,
was there anyone fragged?
NCOs, officers, anybody. Anybody fragged? Getz.
Fragged.
Oh, no. Getz was hit by shrapnel from a frag, but no one, not from his own.
Oh, not from his own men. No, no.
Fragged by.
No.
No one was ever fortunate enough to take out Sergeant Ard.
Oh, no, man. He was
just
too fast.
Just his Chevy.
He was too fast, man. Hey, he was an Alaskan, too, man. He used to hunt polar bear, he told me.
Hey, man, I was going to give him an ice cube.
Well, I believe this guy, man. This guy right here has a spoon from somewhere. Sergeant Ard did.
He was a polar bear.
Hey, he could run, too.
He was a frosty.
Did nobody like him? Did nobody like him? You know, 4th of July, you know, he was standing there on 4th of July. And they give us trailer loads of beer, you know. And we got all kind of drunked up off this beer. So we decided, we throw the warrant officers and the captains into this cold water after we drank the beer. So we was going to get Sergeant Art. Yeah, we're going to give him a bath. Well, everybody took, said, where did Sergeant Art go? He done disappeared, you know. Somebody said, oh, I seen him up there in his barracks. So we're going to go get him. I reckon it might have been about 15 of us. We're going to get him. We're going to drench him in this water. Man, Sergeant Hart looked, seen us coming, he took off running. And I broke out the crowd, about 4 or 5 pretty fast, you know. I kind of passed on by the most of them. Started going up this hill grade, the rest of them, they just, you know, alcohol slow you up, you know. So I was kind of gaining on it. I looked around, everybody else kind of couldn't hardly make it up this hill. Go up the hill to the mess hall.
But it, that's water when they police. Usually ring the...
Yeah, water, water blow
the scramble horn.
Yep.
When you get your hand on the mess hall door, the very lo and behold, said, the scramble horn would blow.
Would go off. The very word he said.
And you wouldn't get anything to
he
eat.
He turned around and looked back at me. He said, I figured you'd be the one trying to catch me. He said, but I got something for you, too. And he ripped this... I wonder what did he have on his gas mask for. He ripped his gas mask out of his pouch and slapped it over his head. And he pulled that pin. It was that gas we go through. Yes. I know it's CS gas. He said, I got something for you, too. He went, boop. And I said, oh, no, gas. And I ran down the hill running, man. But he was smart.
Yeah.
He figured somebody might run him down.
Why didn't you like him?
Why did I catch him?
Why didn't you like him?
The
he was a particular NCO.
The maniac.
He did not like black or Mexican people.
He didn't. He'd tell you
okay.
that.
He was
and
going to tell you that.
I had black and Mexican people as my partners.
He was just done away.
And he was
up front.
He would make them walk point just so he could get them eliminated.
Yeah, he would walk along with you, but he'd tell you up front.
Did that happen a lot? Did you run into
He put me up front.
He played Army. The Army couldn't do nothing to him because he played Army.
By the book.
Mm-hmm. By the book.
But were there other NCOs like him? Other people in your unit?
Thank God. I think Sergeant
Hard was
about the only one
that
was like that.
Yeah.
There are other bigots in the service, but
you know,
he
it's prejudice to everybody. You know, I mean, we might not be prejudiced or racist or prejudiced colors, but it is something you dislike, so you're prejudiced. I mean, it's part of it. But it's really bad, you know, when you're as a human being, just like another human being because of the color of the skin, you know. And I don't think that's too good because you're going to judge a book by looking at the cover. You're going to miss the whole pages. You know?
That's for sure.
It's a story behind all books. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the same thing for human. And you got a brain up here, and everybody carries something. And it's bad that you walk on top of this because I look at it and I say, well, you look like you might be a beatnik. You got a beard on, you know. I ain't going to like you. But then in return, I can't like you if I don't get to know you. But if I get to know you, I should make decision then when I like you or not. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I ask is, of course, one of the things about the Army, especially later in the war, is that accusations or at least comments that there's a lot of racial tension, tensions between different people, different groups of people in the Army.
In our unit,
and
it was...
It seems like it, there was.
Wasn't
well,
it wasn't in our unit.
We were all green, OD. You know.
Probably in some places. But it's directly in the Beatrice or Sacramento Cavalry. I can say, if a person was a racist, and when he did come in this company, he changed because he never showed it. I mean, of all the people I met, he had to change. I mean, if he were in a way, he had to change. Because I never met anybody, to me, that was really racist. I mean, we were really together. And I speak about it right today. If black and whites were together back here in the United States, like we were in the United States,
as close,
we wouldn't have no
and as tight
prejudice. I mean, you know what I mean? It would be so nice.
Mm-hmm.
It would maybe we wouldn't have that killing, the robbing, people pulling this direction, people pulling it. As a whole, the United States, we the people. We are the people.
Amen.
We would be a very strong country if we had the
stronger.
Relationship
stronger.
If we had the relationship across the country like we did in the 2nd, 7th Group and B Group,
we
could run the country.
Yeah, control it.
Yeah.
I mean, not saying that this going to be bad. That's
all no.
Because we like the Constitution, we're the people. If anybody pass a law, and if it don't fit our pocket, what do we need with it? I mean, if you can't, I mean, just say for instance, some things are taken from the country. You know, like you buy an automobile, you should itemize deduction. You take that interest, itemize deduction. Or you, if you borrow money from a finance company, you could itemize.
Well, I was curious about some of the specifics about your injury that you received and when you were injured.
Okay.
Mr. Martinez.
I was wounded on Father's Day, 1970. From my recollections, we were sent out to check out the bomb damage on NBA base camp or hospital. and they had bombed the area quite severely, and we were out there to check out the bomb damage. And it was one of our longer flights out to this place, and I always thought it was in Khe Sanh, that's in North Vietnam, I mean South Vietnam. But the guys were telling me that, no, we were across the border in Laos. And during the checking out this bomb damage, we went through an area that was not bombed. And I passed it back that they missed this part. And we went in, down into a little ravine, and I didn't see anything. Heard some shots fired. And next thing I knew, my arm stopped working. I didn't realize it at the time, but it was a hand grenade wound. But I thought it was a ray gun because I felt the electric shock hit me in the left arm and just put me, knocked my arm out of commission. I continued shooting with my right arm, right hand, changing magazines, about four magazines, while I was down getting... I don't think I took any more fire, but I did put out a lot of bullets. A medic came and patched me up at the out there in the where I was wounded, but nobody came out to get me except for the medic. So I don't know who the medic was, but I have a lot of respect for that cherry boy.
Yeah, he was a new one because regular medic was out.
Yeah, he was on R&R. They sent him one from the battalion. A cherry medic. He shook harder than me with the machine gun, with the M16 going.
Rock and roll.
It was on, yeah, full auto.
How long did it take you to recover?
Uh, 13 months to get my thumb to wiggle, so it was about 2 years, I guess, two and a half years before
plus
I got
a
there.
Month in Japan.
So you were taken out of combat at that point?
Immediately, yeah. They promised me a hook.
I'm sorry, a hook?
They were wanting to cut his arm off.
Oh.
Yes. Cut the radial
amputation.
Nerve.
Amputation.
Yes. Cut the radial nerve.
Amputation.
And I bled like a stuck pig. It took him three compress bandages and two tourniquets to stop the bleeding. And when I went walking back into the unit, I didn't feel any pain, you know. And I was holding my arm up with my M16. Was pushing it up in the air
to stop it.
Stop the bleeding just by holding your arm up. So I'm using my M16 to hold my hand up. And half of my body is red, and the other half is camouflage. So I look like a Christmas tree. And that was my last day in combat.
Just before he went out into that little ravine, he took his last photograph with his camera. And it happened to be the entrance to a bunker complex. It was a tunnel entrance.
Yeah.
And he kept on saying for years and years, doggone, if I hadn't shot my last shot for that stupid tunnel entrance, he could have taken a picture of me red and
green. I guess I made my camera and told him to take a picture of me, and there was no more film.
Yeah.
I just looked really drastic.
He turned white when he saw
so,
yeah, you turned white, according to Roman. He says, saw you, and you was white, whiter than he was.
We've talked about their injuries. Were you ever injured, Mr. Johnson? Or
talk about what then?
Were you ever injured?
No, fortunately, I never got injured.
God put a shield around it.
Yeah, he did. He really did. I wore a boonie hat, just like that one right there. Like punch over here. I had this part turn up and jingles. And I had this part turned up back here, and I had a white cross.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody always
protection.
Told me, yeah, everybody mm-hmm. told me that white cross won't get a bullet between my eyes. Mm-hmm. And I told me if it was God's will, I'd get one between my eyes, but I'm not taking the cross off. And believe it, it was mysteriously, I packed that hat in my duffel bag, and when I got back to Washington State, that hat disappeared.
Oh, my.
I never seen the hat no more. And I wore that hat the whole time I was over there. Well, you got pictures of
I
me.
Have,
uh-huh. That head was hanging on the back of my back, or it was on my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Quentin Eastwood here was never shot, but he could go down the end of his barrel a lot.
His M60.
I did that a lot. I was one of the baddest M60 that went through there.
Oh. I thought it was me.
Was it you?
This is the aerial.
I had to hump mine.
Yeah.
That thing was 25 pounds.
Yeah.
That thing about 25 pounds.
That's him. Uh-huh.
It'd be good.
What about your second injury, Mr. Carver?
We went to get a Ranger team that no one else could get out. And I knew we were in the area, and we were trying to drop ropes to him because we couldn't hover down any closer. And North Vietnamese Army regulars were keeping three of the five alive, so we would keep making attempts to get them out. But that was when Captain Yearwood was received injuries to his face, couldn't see. I got shot. It did bone damage that time, but there was no reason to say, ouch. All you could really think of is to keep your trigger finger pulled back, have your 60 singing. And when the helicopter did three 360s, I felt confident that the perimeter was getting sprayed sufficiently, and it would secure the Rangers on the ground, except for we started going down towards them until Captain Yearwood saved the day. The co-pilot had frozen. He didn't come out with a scratch. He did not respond when Captain Yearwood was yelling at him to take the controls. But Yearwood could see. It's like a lineless blanket of a horizon between the jungle and the sky. And he took the controls and flew us all the way back to Phu Bai.
That's amazing.
And that was my last flight. And he was, I really respect that man a lot.
You would, I respect.
Yes,
he was a good
definitely.
Man.
And when I woke up, I saw two of the Rangers that we were trying to rescue. There were number two and number three beds over. And I asked him how the hell they got out of there. And a loach had swooped in there after we left and came out of nowhere, came in so fast, picked them up, and they were gone. And had him back to safety.
A little helicopter right there.
And so I was so happy to see those two Rangers. At least two out of the five had made it. If it was an officer that was with them, I wouldn't see him anyway, because even in the hospital, they didn't put the officers with the enlisted personnel. Now and then, you would have an enemy soldier that was wounded. But then you would just torture him with your mind, if you could, by making gestures like cutting his throat. And it would make him a nervous wreck. But he could have shot my partner. So if I could, at all possible, I would love to have killed him, but they would have court-martialed me.
Lord,
because
yeah.
They wanted to question him and get him well, question him. And you just I just thought of something in the first air cab that I could add a little bit of when the South Vietnamese Army would take prisoners up and question them. They would take them up in pairs and would push the first one out to make a point with the second one that he better start singing. And it didn't bother me at all to have him pushed out.
Yeah, we did.
It was all part of the war.
Making them up.
Yeah.
You take them up in the helicopter.
It was against the Geneva Convention. But a lot of the things they did
they
to our men.
Our men, like shooting them.
It would be like the Japanese in World War II. They'd skin them alive.
They would get the Geneva Convention to dismembrate a human being, but they did it anyway.
Right. And they would leave them hanging from a tree.
Yeah.
And
with their penis in their mouth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they were doing all
that kind of shit. Kind of pisses you off, and then you just retaliate with full force.
You see this stuff.
It's like, you know.
And they urinate on bamboos, they cut up spikes, and you step on it, and it's poison. If you urinate on a bamboo, it's really poison. If you step on it, it punctures you, you're going to die.
They put the brown stuff on it, man.
You're going to die.
Yeah, they put the brown stuff on it, too. They fire harden the bamboo, and they put the brown stuff on it. The sickest one in the group.
Yeah.
So they didn't live by the Geneva Convention?
No, they didn't play.
They didn't fight.
They didn't play by the rules.
They didn't fight no fair fight.
You mentioned that it happened at first cab. What about didn't have much of B troop or
no?
Good.
No, not at all. If there was a scout that was Vietnamese, he would be on our side, and I would never push him out.
Oh, yeah, scout. One of those guys was really intelligent. I can't think of his name. You should remember.
He was Vietnamese?
Yeah, Vietnamese. He's
the one you gave the haircut to?
I was trying to think that I cut his out.
But that was the one that went down with Roman. They both picked up different pieces in the same hand grenade.
We had two of them. One of them was an interpreter, and one of them was a scout.
Yeah.
I had two different scouts. One of them was pretty cool guy. One of them, you know, he was a dead NBA. You could tell he was scared, and they bring him back to Georgia, I think, and they trained him, and they because they know the terrain features. Too hard, I mean, they surrender on the outside, and he's supposed to go back and be willing to lead us through the terrain. And this one kid, Sergeant Ott, was out there on this operation, and this guy was going to shoot me. I knew he was going to shoot me. And, you know, he wouldn't participate either. You know, like, he'd be first and I'd be next. I'm walking point at this time. Now, you was gone. You probably still there. But you didn't see this because you fly on a helicopter. We chop through this thicket and we get to a bum cradle and we go across the bum cradle. But you don't be running. Now, you taking your time moving along because you might run up on something. And it got to another little thing, then we cut through that. So I hand him the machete, you know. I said, hey, your time, chop, chop. He couldn't talk English either. And he said, no, me no chop. I said, okay, you know, that's cool. I chop through this, and next time we trade off. Next time we get to a thing, you know, it's going to be your turn to chop. So Sergeant Ott done woke himself in the backs for some reason, dog. So we get up there, and I say, hey, buddy, you know, your time to chop, chop. He said, me no chop. I said, yeah, you're going to chop through here. I said, you're not going along just for the ride. I mean, them the words I said. And you can tell by the instinct of it. I couldn't understand the word. He went to mumbling something, but his eyebrows kind of did like that. And that Jugger Rock, he did Girl. That. He locked around there. He wasn't allowed to carry around in his chamber. We was allowed to carry around in the chamber and on rock and roll. But you got to be safe with it because you don't want to kill your fellow men. But this guy, he locked the road around in it, mm-hmm. in the chamber. And Sergeant Ott got up there. I think he got there on time because I was going to shoot this guy. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to let him turn around and aim that gun at me. I was going to shoot this guy. And he took the gun from him and put him in the back. And I told him, keep him away from me because, hey, I looked at his looks. You know, you people's eyes can tell you things. And, mm-hmm. and I looked at his eyes when he locked that round, and what did he put that
round
in?
He was serious.
Yeah, he wasn't going to chop either, man. Hmm.
Were there any incidents of fratricide, maybe your men being killed by each other?
This
all?
Guy, he was a leader. Now, this guy's supposed to be your friend and your buddy. And, you know, you don't sleep y'all down like that, but you're in this war together, and he's supposed to be leading you through this terrain. And I could tell this guy, he didn't want to be there. He was an NVA that probably too hard to save his life. And he went through all this American training and sat back over there, and he still was a too hard. Wasn't a too hard, my opinion. He would have run. If he could have got back, he would have left us. If he could have killed us and got away, he would have did that too.
Well, I mean, that and friendly fire incidents where you know, like the helicopter that spun around and shot that rock into the trees above you. Were there ever any incidents where you came into contact with other American units or even elements within your own unit and you started firing amongst each other and by mistake?
No. The only time we did that was that time I told you we shot our own men up.
The one guy up in front of the perimeter.
Okay. Other than that, we had never... run into the contact of any of our other men.
I have an interesting aspect of it, and I thought that I did see, and the two rangers confirmed it, that leading that element was one tall, blonde-haired American, white.
Yes, he was.
And two Chinese. They were leading the
NVA.
NVA And I knew I saw an American down there that wasn't with the Rangers, and I thought, no, because it all happened so fast. But he confirmed it in the hospital that there was one blonde-haired, white American and two Chinese, tall Chinese. Well, Chinese were tall as opposed to Vietnamese anyway.
Yeah, Red China was.
And they were leading the element. And all that did was want me to kill. Well, I never got an opportunity to, though. After that, I was just in the hospital the rest of my time.
Is it possible that he was Russian, the white guy?
Well, we were thinking, I don't think it's any Russian blonde.
Well, see,
true blonde.
If the Rangers would say that he was an American,
but what we
they knew he was an American. They weren't just spreading a rumor. They had confirmed that probably even before the Rangers were discovered, they probably knew he was American, and they could give a description of him. And he did have a bounty on his head too.
Yeah, I imagine he might have got captured, and to save his life, he had to do what he had to do. You know, and then later on, he could have turned to that side. You don't never know. People defect. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know what you might do on a mental stress.
Why don't we get to some of the post-Vietnam experiences you had? I guess we should probably do this one by one. Mr. Martinez, how did the Vietnam War affect you most? How was it important in your life?
I buried the war for almost 20 years. Going to the wall back in 89... First time I went back here, and I was trying to remember somebody who was my brother who really touched me, and I couldn't remember his name, and all I could remember was Jungle George, and he was from Georgia, and the lady at the wall looked through the computer and data casualty rank and all this kind of stuff, and until I narrowed the names down from 200 names to like 35, and this name kept jumping out at me, George Wall.
Why was George significant?
Because George was the guy I befriended over there, and he was a recent, his wife was pregnant, and he was getting ready to go home. He was supposed to go home before I was extended in country. But when I got wounded, 2 days later, George was killed. And my survival guilt went up because I felt like if I hadn't got wounded, he wouldn't have had to go to the field that day, and he would have been able to go home and see his little girl, and it probably would have been me. So I thank God for just taking my arm instead of my life, and I didn't realize the survivor's guilt was so prevalent until then. Took a couple more years before I got into therapy by the urgence of my wife. Found out that the war had done some real deep-seated psychological imbalances in me. I have a master's degree in social work, and I had no idea how post-traumatic stress had worked on me. But luckily, my second wife got me into therapy, and come to find out all of the weird behavior that I had participated in was, you know, triggered by Vietnam memories, the toasted buddies relating to barbecuing at home, and the survivor's instinct on how to kill rather than be killed was very deep-seated. And unfortunately, Anybody who was perceived by my psyche as the enemy could die. Be it wife, neighbor, brother, the enemy must be destroyed. So it took a while for me to get over that. You know, I was very much of a peace-loving person, but if the pin was pulled, bad things would happen. So luckily now, Better Living Through Chemistry, VA and its new medications has helped me to get a handle on my violence. And I was trained to kill at a very young age. And it was good to be trained like that in war. But unfortunately, without an off switch, it's really hard to go back to
normal living.
Yeah.
Were you proud of your service in Vietnam?
Not until recently. I guess it was mid-80s when I tried to get my Purple Heart wasn't even on my discharge, so I got my upgrade and come to find out that, you know, I got air medals, Bronze Stars, Purple Heart, and I knew I was into all kinds of funny stuff while I was out there, and I had this old Juan Wayne syndrome, ready to jump on a hand grenade at the moment's notice, or blow up without a hand grenade. So it's really good to be alive and to see my brother still here with me. You know, it's almost 30 years, and that we're here. You know, older and wiser and tamer.
Mr. Carper, how about you?
I didn't have a drinking problem until I came home from Vietnam. I held a lot inside. I did a lot of traveling, hitchhiking, drinking heavy. I would stay, let's say, indoors, not answer the phone, not answer the door if someone knocked. I wanted to be left alone. I found it better that way, I thought. I didn't realize that socially that I was impaired, and it was like a turtle going in its shell, trying to protect itself. And I tried to go to college. I couldn't concentrate. Not until 93, 94 was I able to go to college and get anything out of it and actually enjoy it, because it was no longer something that I needed to support my family. It was a hobby. I'm married to the same wife that I had from the beginning, and I have four children, four grandchildren. Last year, my granddaughter, who's the oldest of the grandchildren, wrote a term paper. She knows that Grandpa went through a lot, and sometimes needs it quiet. I know that she wrote something about, I can't even talk.
That's right.
Well, you want to know how it affected me?
Mm-hmm.
It kind of affected me. I'm the type of person that I think I'm in control all the time. I go through all this stuff I see. It kind of bothered me. And Sergeant Law got killed. I was on R&R when he got killed. He was a real nice guy. You know, we were real close. And when I got back, I discovered that he had got killed. That bothered me for a while. I guess it made me stronger out there because he was a little older than I were in the company. Then that makes me old, what they call old timer. And the new kids, they looking up to me, you know. So I start walking point, and we had quite a bit of trouble out there. But the real trouble was when I got back home. I drank a little over there for a little. I drank right smart. I probably drank every day if I could have got my hand on it. Not knowing that I was had that problem, you know. When I got back home, I got my old job back, and I married my girlfriend, and I still continue to drink. I mean, you know, it was a party time, I thought, you know, but it wasn't party time, I don't guess. I think I was just drinking, trying not to have this stuff in front of me, and thinking it's all behind me, but it was really just beginning. I outran the law meetings, I wrecked cars, and I fought them. I go to court and I pull my own defense counselor and I win the case. But then I got a white-haired judge. These guys jumped on me one time. You know, I was the type of guy, I didn't like violence. Some guy jumped on me for another guy. And I kind of beat him up. But about 6 or 7 jumped on me and then kind of cut up 2 of them. You know, they trickled that back out of me, you know. And like I tell a lot of them, it's 2 of them, and the other one, you don't want to call him up. If you call him up, you're going to answer to him. And that's what happened. And they called him up, and I did some damage to those guys. Well, I had to go to court for it, and the judge told me, you got a pretty wife. He said, you don't need to be out there. See, you need to stay at home with her, which I know I got a pretty wife, I'm thinking. And I'm going to be at home with her, but I just want to go out to a club and with the friends and take a couple of drinks, not knowing trouble. But then that kind of gave me a rude awakening. I started looking back at myself. Hard for you wanting to see oneself. So I started looking at myself. I said I was going to get out and go to school. I hadn't done any of that. And so the year of 74, I started preparing to try to get into some schooling. 75, I enrolled in ACC in Hall River in North Carolina. I pulled 3 years of transportation maintenance. And then 2 years later, I took up another year of industrial maintenance and electromechanical technology, which I started getting a little better. Well, between that time, me and my wife got separated, and that's another thing kind of jiggled me, because my behavior was nothing less of results of what left me in Vietnam. You know, when I left, it, like I say, you're a train killer, and this stuff just don't leave you, and all this stuff you've seen, it don't leave you. It just brings the violence out of you. If you jog that memory or just hit that one key and it turns you on. And I think that's the baddest part about coming back to the world. Because you got to adjust everything. And people want to ask you questions. Did you kill anybody? How many did you kill? You don't want to hear that. I mean, you want to talk about it, try to get it off. But, hey. I know how many I killed. I know I was shooting a high power weapon automatic, and we picked up dead bodies. So, you know, to yourself, you be saying, really, how many did you kill? But you ain't want to come back here and brag about it. It wasn't nothing to brag about, but it was something that you need to talk about. When you find yourself, you can't talk to nobody because they ain't been over there.
Mm-hmm.
See what I'm saying? Only someone you can relate to is another Vietnam vet. And you didn't run across them that way. They were probably isolated like all the rest of us. If you weren't inside your home locked up, you was outside doing devilment, the old folks call it. You know, that's about the worstest part of the experience I got out of Vietnam War. They tie you up for years at home. And I got a good wife. She put up with that for a long time. A lot of times she would get up. I would wake up in the morning. She'd be on the sofa.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be wondering, why are you on the sofa? She'd say, I fought in my sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I never remember it.
Same here.
Were you proud of your service? Were you proud of your service in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No doubt about that. You know, it learned me that we had power. We never been a weak nation. No doubt in my mind, we could have won that war in 1 week. From what I seen on that arc light dropped on that mountainside that day. We could have dropped that on Hanoi any time. And maybe they didn't want to kill innocent. You know, because we are always sentimental, and that's what they played on our integrity. When it comes to kids and women, we was always, and innocent, we always sentimental. And a lot of us got killed because of that.
How about you, Mr. Harper? Were you proud of your service?
Oh, I just stood with the family colors. I was just another generation that my brother and I both continued on the name and the, as far as volunteering and doing our job for our country. We did that, and I didn't even think about it until somebody said, well, it seemed like you did more than you were supposed to. I mean, what is more? I don't understand that. That's just like, what is normal? I don't know. It all depends on the individual's outlook. But I was really happy with the job I had. I had a job to do. I did the best of my ability. And it came to where the pilots knew that when they came out to fly my helicopter, they didn't even have to pull a pre-flight because they knew that the helicopter was not going to fall out of the air because of a mistake I made. I mean, I'm human. I do make mistakes. But as far as the helicopter being flyable, there was nothing wrong with it because I would go over it with a fine-tooth comb while we would not be in the air. And I think we talked earlier about when we were in situations to where it's not the best, and let's say we are injured or whatever, as long as you remain calm, you can still do your job to the best of your ability. And I've never really thought of being proud of what I did, but I guess with the first cab and the second 17th cab, 101st, if you look back, I guess my relatives would be proud of what I did and what my brother Chuck did. It's hard for me to think of being proud of what I did. I'm thankful that I'm here and still alive. And without God protecting me, I wouldn't be here right now. And there was a reason. There's a reason for us being together right now. Yeah. There's a reason for us sitting here talking about this that for years upon years we couldn't share with anybody.
Maybe I should ask it a different way. Are you proud of what we did in Vietnam, the United States, what we were fighting for?
Yes, but I'll say I, because I'm speaking for myself and not for everyone else. We did have to fight with one hand behind our back at times in the first cab, but thanks to men like Captain Yearwood, instead of getting permission to fire, if we were fired upon, you return fire. He'll accept the responsibilities of, let's say, if anything negative happened, but flying usually in the area that we had and to areas that we flew into, there were no villages or civilians, so we didn't have to worry about that like we did down south in the 3 Corps. To get fired at and to try to request permission to return fire seems stupid to me.
Yes. Somebody's shooting you up, and you're going to lose your...
I know.
Call it for permission to fire back. Somebody's going to kill you.
One night, I don't know why this came to my mind, but there was a helicopter that was flying at night with no navigation lights, and we discovered that it was a Russian-made helicopter. The gunships, the Cobras, were trying to get permission to fire on it, and I had my M60 aimed at it, and it was there was a moonlight out, but what was crossing my mind is this is a medevac helicopter taking wounded back in to get help. So I didn't say anything to any of the rest of the crew, but in my mind I thought, just let them go. They're already screwed up. They're not going to be any harm to us. Let them go.
Is that the time that the gunship couldn't catch that? Did they outflew the sleep?
They flew across into Laos, and we let them go.
And they had some pretty fast ships, though.
Yeah. This Russian helicopter was really clicking probably 120 knots anyway, but no lights on. And why shoot it down, even though the gunship pilots really wanted to shoot it down, just so they could put a different kind of mark on their Cobra?
You wanted to get him before he got away.
I was glad to see that the helicopter did get away, because there was no soldiers on board there that could have been any harm to us, really, unless they were on the ground.
It could have been one of ours, you know. With no lights
on. It's possible.
One last question. What should we as a nation and as individuals learn from the Vietnam War?
If you're going to get into it, get into it.
Yes.
Don't mamby-pamby.
No hand tied behind
your back. A 10-year-long fuck around was an abomination. Thank God that our technology has allowed us to get through one skirmish without putting any grunts on the ground. That was sweet. The 100-hour war, that was nice. And I pray that we never have anything that, when we came home, to been spit on for our duty to our country. That was one of the reasons I hid out, because, going back to area around Berkeley, California, and being called baby killers and warmongers and stuff like that. We didn't want to do it, but we had a job to do. And if we didn't do it to the best of our ability, we would be dead. I feel that we have done our duty above and beyond the call of duty. And you're real modest, but there's a term for it. It's super arrogant. Doing above and beyond the call of duty.
Yeah.
And, we had to be that proficient to live and to keep our brothers alive. And we fought for that.
That was real great.
That was important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was the most important job I've ever had in my life. Period.
Do you both feel the same, Mr. Carper? Lessons that we should learn from the Vietnam War? Any others?
I'm sorry, you caught me off balance here, and my brain is about to shut down like a computer.
How about you, Mr. Johnson?
What was the most important?
What should we as individuals, and what should we as a nation, what should we learn from the Vietnam War experience?
Well, we should learn that, like Martinez says, we shouldn't have no long-term war. I think it's sensitive to put human lives out there, If it's a war, if you can't negotiate and come to terms, a peace term, if you're going to go to war, go to war. I mean, and it's bad looking at it that way, but why feed people lives over a period of years when you could end this 2 or 3 weeks? Because I take, for instance, like Saddam Hussein. The man is halfway crazy. The Bible says the smaller nations are supposed to rise up in the east, and he's supposed to rule the world. And he going to designate himself as this smaller nation. And this is most likely what he's all about, because he got oil, and the world is supplied off this oil, or the demands is after this oil. And it's plentiful to him, too plentiful, because he want to talk all this noise. And then we fire upon him, he reach over there and smack Israel. If I talk junk to you and you reach over and smack Rome, I mean, what is that? And I looked at this man, and then in the end, after we cut the bumming off, he likes all these oil wells. Man, they said the skies were black for months.
Even
to the sea shore, man. I mean, oil slick. I mean, just all on the beaches. If you, and this world is pretty rich, it's just real, with wealth on this world. And this man is part of this wealth. I mean, why would he do that? I mean, for what reason? I mean, psychologically, he can buy anything he want to in this world with money. He got the oil wells. Why not just go ahead on and be peaceful and sell all this oil and get be a rich country if that's what he want? Why would you want to rule the world anyway? You know, to my knowledge, man, in my recollection, I would say people like that is kind of like sick, you know. They don't need to be in control of anything. Just like Hitler. He didn't have no remorse for human beings because he just killed them and threw them inside ditches, you know. Why would you want to honor a person like that, you know? So I look at the Vietnam War and all of this stuff going on. We should learn, and I hope we did, but we should never go beyond that boundary again, you know, because human beings is fragile, beautiful things in life, you know. I mean, we're human beings, and I don't think nobody should be abused, and I don't think nobody should be fearful of this or that, but you got crazy people in the world, and just like just nuclear gas, you guys know as well as I know. I mean, if this stuff escape out, it's going to travel to places, right? We can be all protective and secure of ours as we possibly can. Other countries buying up this stuff, and I think this is getting got real serious. It's escaping out. It attacked the respiratory system. Mm-hmm. It do you like flu-like symptoms. I mean, these guys exposed to that heavy radiation, this plutonium and stuff, and these guys probably going to die. You know, you see what I'm saying? They're going to die pretty quick. But this stuff is going to travel to Earth. It's going to travel to face the Earth. It's going to come over. It's probably some already. They talk about a new virus out, or a new flu bug out. What do you think it is? Nerve gas. Mm-hmm. It's a flu-like symptom. Mm-hmm. And that's all this stuff is in the air that people are getting. It done hit me twice because I used to catch the flu. And I knew the difference in a flu and this stuff. And this stuff got flu-like symptoms, but it's not doing me like flu. Yeah, I mean, it's totally different than what I ever had. So, you know, the nation, we don't got in a bad fix, really. The world, from people like Saddam and other people that want to have this power, and they want to stock up all and store up all of this nuclear war here for power. If you shoot one over here, we're going to shoot one back. And it's done got to the point where man is going to destroy mankind.
Man's going to destroy the earth.
No, he won't destroy the earth. He ain't big enough to destroy the earth. But that gas can kill everything upon it.
This is what I'm saying. Oh, I hear. I see the light at the end of the tunnel. What you just said, what I said.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Man's going to destroy man.
Mankind. That's what he's going to do.
Mr. Carper, have you thought of anything maybe you want to add as far as what you think we should learn from Vietnam?
Just no matter what situation you're in, always give it your best. I don't care what my neighbor says. I personally, my wife said I should care. I'll say a prayer for them.
Yeah, then you can.
But if they want to gossip behind my back, that's fine with me.
They're going to do that anyway.
They're going to do that anyway. That's true.
Yeah, give her a fist, you make a right.
I would not sell my experience that I had with these gentlemen for any amount of money in the world. Money doesn't mean happiness. Money pays bills. Money will help the country. But the true feelings I have inside here that Vietnam taught me was to care more about these chosen few. And I try to instill this in my children. And they just see that I did my best to raise them. I want them all to go to college. I really want to thank my wife because she's been a great support to me all these years. She's been like my nurse. I've had my own personal nurse. And she can respond to my thinking, even without me saying it. She responds, and I appreciate that. I really do. So, Vietnam veteran or just a veteran itself, I think we did learn a lot. We did grow up a lot in a short period of time. And if I had it to do over again, I'd do it again.
I think I want to be a wimp.
No. That's not your personality. That's just like when I was in mechanics. I wanted to fly. I couldn't be there.
I used to hate rimps. I mean, I tell you, I used to hate rimps. Now I found out that I hate rimps because I really wanted to be a rimp, man. Instead of being.
I was just going to say, Mrs. Martinez, you want to add something?
Yeah, it's real important to me that the nation as a whole takes away from the Vietnam conflict the fact that it affected our entire nation. And not everybody served. Let's face it. Some people got out of it. I think that it's the duty of every citizen to serve their country in one way or another. I served through the Red Cross. I was an Army brat. I was raised with it. I think that true citizenship has to come with service, one way or another, and that there needs to be an underlying respect and support of our veterans because of their sacrifices. This nation is so ready to take the budget for the veterans and throw it at roads and other concerns that they've forgotten the promise that they had made when these men signed up. I think it's time to respect and honor the sacrifice that they've made.
Good.
And keep your promises as a nation. If you're going to throw a war, let the warriors fight it and support them. Don't be picking behind their backs and say, oh, our budget can't handle it. Because this is not what made this nation strong. It was the warriors that made this nation strong. That's how we got the vote. That's how we secured the vote for 18-year-olds, was because these little youngins went out there and fought before they had the vote, even though it wasn't fair, even though it wasn't right. They sought justice for their fellow Americans, and that commands respect.
That's right. Yeah, several times.
Well, I guess this should conclude our interview then.
Well, I knew what y'all were doing.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah.